Life, wrote the great Roman orator Cicero, is nothing without friendship. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. Looking at Adam, by himself, in the fresh beauty of Eden, God declared, "It is not good for the man to be alone." We humans, from our creation, are, as someone put it, hardwired to connect. We need friends, and without them, as St. Thomas Aquinas observed, even the most agreeable pursuits become tedious. All this being the case, you can understand why friendship is the subject of innumerable novels, short stories, poems, essays, philosophical works, theological works, and films. And it's the reason that the just completed 2019 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought explored No Greater Gift, Friendship from the Iliad to Facebook. Well, while we can't recreate the seminars, dinner conversations, and conviviality of the week, we did record lectures and will present them this summer as podcasts, going beyond our typical 15-minute interview format. This week we'll begin with the talk that I gave about friendship in the Bible, using the story of David and Jonathan from the Old Testament book of 1 Samuel. It seems to me that while we're all anxious to get going, it's nonetheless been a long day of travel for everyone, and now we've had a nice big dinner. And so rather than present a tightly reasoned argument for something that demands your rapt attention at every moment lest you be completely lost, I'll simply begin with my conclusion and work my way back into it. So, in conclusion, in his article about phileos, or brotherly love, in the sprawling theological dictionary of the New Testament, Gustav Stalin wrote, "The Old Testament contains one of the finest instances of friendship. In the final strophe of David's lament for Saul and Jonathan, we read, 'I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of women.'" The final thought, Stalin comments, "is common to antiquity, and David and Jonathan are also worthy to rank with the other pairs of friends extolled in ancient literature. The story that ends with the lament is itself a song in praise of friendship. It is said of the two friends that they loved one another as their own life, the supreme stage of human fellowship." To reach that conclusion about David and Jonathan, I want to use the story as told in 1 Samuel and the sayings about friends and friendship from the wisdom books, from Proverbs, from Sirach, and from Ecclesiastes. Old Testament scholar Derek Kidner, in his commentary on Proverbs, breaks the sayings in Proverbs about friendship into four categories: constancy, or we might say commitment, candor, counsel, and tact. Well, we'll take out tact, since if Kinder can't think of another C word, why bother? No. We'll take it out because the verses he puts into that category are things like, "Whoever blesses a neighbor with a loud voice rising early in the morning will be counted as cursing." And that really doesn't apply to our story of David and Jonathan, though it may apply tomorrow morning at breakfast, so just keep that in mind. So let me begin by introducing the characters, and then we'll talk about constancy, candor, and counsel. In 1 Samuel 13, we're introduced to Jonathan, who is the crown prince of Israel. His dad is King Saul, and when we meet him, Jonathan is already a warrior and a captain of warriors. The first thing we're told is he had one eliph, typically translated 1,000, that he led to victory over a small Philistine garrison. That in turn led to a showdown with a much larger Philistine force. Before the battle, it was customary for Samuel to show up and sacrifice to the Lord and ask his blessing. This time, however, Samuel was running late, And King Saul, rather than waiting for Samuel, took it upon himself to offer the sacrifices in direct disobedience to the Mosaic law, but in accordance with the custom of kings at the time. When Samuel finally arrived, he was furious. And he said, 1 Samuel 13:13, "You have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him to be prince over the people, because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." Saul would no longer be king because of his disobedience, and that meant Crown Prince Jonathan would not become king after him. Now, the text does not tell us whether or not Jonathan overheard these words of Samuel, but it seems to me he was the crown prince, Saul was the king, it's likely that he did. And that makes a big difference, which we'll see in a moment. Well, the next day, Jonathan, rather than waiting around for the Philistines to attack or do something, in 14:6, takes action. And in 14:6, we read, "Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, 'Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or few.'" There's a little bit of David and Goliath in that, isn't there? Instead of one big warrior, Jonathan, all alone, went to face a whole bunch of regular-sized warriors, but they were warriors nonetheless. These Philistines, from Jonathan's point of view, had defied God's people, had defied God, and something had to be done. The Lord, he says, has given them into our hands. Then he and his armor bearer marched up the hill, killed the first 25 that they saw, and watched the Philistine camp break into a panic. And then came an earthquake, and that caused even more panic. The battle, as Jonathan believed, belonged to the Lord, and the Lord had won a great victory through Jonathan. In a similar way, before his battle with Goliath, David said, "Your servant has killed both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." "This is not about me," said David. "This is about God. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." We see in Jonathan's words and actions, and in David's words and actions, deep faith. Both these young men knew God, and it seems they knew the history of God's people and how God delivered his people in the past, with many, or more likely, with few. And they both trusted in the Lord for deliverance and for victory in the battles for God's cause. Now, while Jonathan was the crown prince, David wasn't a crown anything. The story of Samuel anointing David as king in 1 Samuel 16 has always made me laugh. I think it's kind of a funny story. I don't know whether the text is meant to be funny, but I'm always amused by it. Samuel goes to Bethlehem to anoint one of Jesse's children to be the new king. The first one walks up and Samuel says, "Ah, well, boy, there's the guy. He's so good looking. This must be the Lord's choice." Well, no. Saul was extremely good looking as well. Verse 7 of chapter 16. "The Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord does not see as man sees. Man looks at outward appearances, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" So seven sons of Jesse walk up one by one, but none of them is the one. And in verse 11, Samuel said to Jesse, "Are all your sons here?" And I just have this, you know, it gives it straight. I just have this picture of, of Jesse saying, "Oh, my son's here." There is another one now that you mention it. But we didn't even bother calling him in from tending the flocks. The eighth son is way down on the totem pole. But of course, that's the one God chose. And David ended up being the one Saul chose as well. Later in chapter 16, when Saul was oppressed by an evil spirit, singer-songwriter David played the lyre and sang to him to calm his nerves. David eventually became one of Saul's attendants and an armor bearer. And David loved Saul, and Saul, like most other people, loved David. Interesting that Jonathan was also greatly loved by one and all. So much so that when Saul wanted to kill Jonathan for an offense against a rash, stupid vow Saul had made, the army sided with Jonathan, and the text said they ransomed him. Everybody loved him. Now, I'll say more about Jonathan and David's character as we go along, but that's a start. They were both brave, they were both loved by nearly everyone, and above all, they both had a strong faith in God as their Lord and as their deliverer. As a result, they accomplished great things for Israel. Now on to their friendship. Number one, constancy. Proverbs 17:17 says, "A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity." Proverbs 18:24, "There are friends who pretend to be friends, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother." And Sirach 6:7, "When you gain a friend, gain him through testing, and do not trust him hastily." While the wisdom books talk a good deal about friends and friendship and being a good friend, they also warn us to be wary of friends. The book of Sirach, in particular, issues warning before giving encouragement. Sirach chapter 6, starting with verse 7. "When you gain a friend, gain him through testing. Do not trust him hastily. For there is a friend who is such at his own convenience, but will not stand by you on the day of trouble. And there is a friend who changes into an enemy and will disclose a quarrel to your disgrace. And there is a friend who is a table companion, but will not stand by you in the day of trouble. In prosperity, he will make himself your equal and be bold with your servants. But if you are brought low, he will turn against you and will hide himself from your presence. Keep yourself far from your enemies and be on your guard toward your friends." Because nobody knows you when you're down and out. No, that's not in the text. "A faithful friend, on the other hand, is a sturdy shelter. And he that has found one has found a treasure. There is nothing so precious as a faithful friend, and no scales can measure his excellence. A faithful friend is an elixir of life, and those who fear the Lord will find him. Whoever fears the Lord directs his friendship aright, for as he is, so his neighbor is also." Real friends need time to be proved and proven true. The friendship between Jonathan and David was like that, tried and true. They loved one another at all times. They were born for adversity and stuck closer than brothers. In chapter 18, beginning at verse 1, "When he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house." Notice, Saul took him. "Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David, and his armor and even his sword and his bow and his belt." Chapter 16, verses 14 and following indicate that David was around the palace before his battle with Goliath. So it's likely that he and Jonathan knew each other already. here, after the battle with Goliath, something new happens. Jonathan loved him as his own soul. He became attached to David. The same language was used in Genesis to describe how attached Jacob was to his youngest son, Benjamin. There was an inseparable devotion, souls knit together. And David and Jonathan swore a covenant. They promised one another loyalty. As Gustav Stalin went on to say, from the quote I had earlier, "It is characteristic of antiquity that the friendship should be sealed with a solemn pact and thus made unbreakable. The decisive symbolic act of handing over cloak and weapons of the king's son and heir to David so that he is made the alter ego of his friend." Now, much of the relationship between Jonathan and David was personal. I mean, there's no question about that. David and Jonathan were like brothers. In fact, they became brothers-in-law. But part of their friendship had to do with the fact that we're talking about the royal court and the royal family and the dynasty, the now rejected dynasty of Saul, to which Jonathan belongs. Jonathan, I think, knew, even here, that David would be king instead of him. That would, in part, explain giving the rare commodities of armor, spear, and sword, and the swearing of an oath. In this text, we actually have the first of three covenants between Jonathan and David, and the second, verse 13. "But should it please my father to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan and much more if I do not disclose it to you." And he says, "If I am still alive, show me the loyal love of the Lord, that I might not die, and do not cut off your loyalty from my house." When the Lord cuts off everyone from the enemies of David from the face of the earth, let not the name of Jonathan be cut off from the house of David. And may the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies. And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. At this point, it is certain that Jonathan knew that he would not be king, but David would be king instead of him. "If I'm still alive." In this covenant, Jonathan is concerned not so much about himself as about his children. What happens to the royal family when a king is overthrown? That's right, the new king kills off the old dynasty. And that same concern is even more apparent in the final covenant that David and Jonathan make in chapter 23. David is on the run, and Jonathan goes to meet him and met David at Horesh and strengthened his hand in God. And he said to him, "Fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you, and you shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Saul my father also knows this." And the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. David remained at Horesh, and Jonathan went home. This is the only one of the three covenants that we read specifically was made before the Lord, although the other two likely were as well. It's a solemn vow before God of permanent friendship. These covenants, within the context of friendship, kind of sound weird to our modern ears, right? I mean, who does that anymore? Aside from maybe pledging a fraternity or a sorority, or joining a Presbyterian church, you know, we don't make these kinds of vows, except in marriage. And does anybody remember being blood brothers? Did anybody ever actually do that? Yeah, we'll just be good friends. You know, we didn't want to cut ourselves, but yeah, I mean, who talks about that anymore? I mean, that's just gone from our culture. And that being the case, and insofar as same-sex marriage is in the background of our thinking, which we have no choice of, and insofar as there are numerous commentators who desperately search the Bible for homoerotic themes, let me briefly address that question. New Testament scholar Dr. Robert Gagnon, who is now at Houston Baptist University, having lost his job as a tenured professor at Pittsburgh Seminary because he defended marriage and biblical sexuality, Rob Gagnon has done the lion's share of the work on these questions, and he has a website, and you can visit that. Gagnon writes, "The point of emphasizing the close relationship between David and Jonathan was to establish the fact that David was not a rogue usurper to Saul's throne. He was rather adopted by Jonathan into his father's house, family, or dynasty. He has become Jonathan's beloved older brother. Neither the narrators of the succession narratives nor the authors of the Deuteronomistic history show concern about homosexual scandal. The reason for this is that in the context of ancient Near Eastern convention, nothing in the narrative raises suspicions about a homosexual relationship." So Jonathan's relationship with David, in addition to being chaste, was constant. He was the kind of friend who loves at all times, is closer to a brother who is made for adversity. He loved David in the good days of chapter 18, and as the situation deteriorated, forcing David to run for his life from Saul. As for David, we see the constancy of the friendship in his hymn of lament in 2 Samuel 1, and we also see it in an amazing way in 2 Samuel 9. Again, as I said, it was typical that a new king forming a new dynasty kills the old king and his entire family. "Why have anyone left alive who has a claim to your hard-won throne?" But rather than killing off everyone from Saul's dynasty, David said, "Is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I can show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" It turns out that there was a son of Jonathan who was lame in both feet, and I take it could not walk. His name is Mephibosheth. And we read in chapter 9, verses 6 and 7, "Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and did obeisance. And David said, 'Mephibosheth,' and he answered, 'Behold, your servant.' And David said to him, 'Do not fear, for I will show kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore you all the land of,'" not Jonathan your father, "'but all the land of Saul. And you shall eat at my table always. I'll make you a very rich man, and just so you know, you're never going to have to spend any money because I'm going to take care of you the rest of your life. This is an amazing show of friendship and constancy and loyalty. A friend exhibits constancy. A friend is in it for the long haul. And second, a true friend is marked by candor. Proverbs 27:6, "Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Profuse are the kisses of an enemy." Friends tell each other the truth. And we see that, I think, particularly in chapter 20 of 1 Samuel. And before we get there, the beginning of chapter 19 reads, "Saul spoke to Jonathan his son and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David." David escaped from the royal palace with the help of his wife, Saul's daughter, and fled to Samuel at Ramah. Then, slinking around the land, trying to avoid Saul's men, all of whom, except Jonathan, are trying to kill him, David found Jonathan and confided in him, his friend, his deepest concerns and fears. "What have I done?" said David. "What's my guilt? What is my sin before your father that he seeks my life? There is but a step between me and death. If there is guilt in me, slay me yourself. For why should you bring me to your father?" Saul wanted to kill David, lest David, who again was wildly popular among Saul's subjects, become the new king and Saul's dynasty end. He already enlisted Jonathan's help in his effort to kill David, And after all, by this time, everybody, including Saul and Jonathan, knew that if David lived, Jonathan would never be king because David would be king. Ergo, Jonathan had an enormous incentive to kill David then and there, or alternatively, to bring him to Saul so Saul could kill him. It seems to me the key sentence in the text is in verse 8, "Deal kindly with your servant," says David to Jonathan, "for you have brought your servant into a sacred covenant with you." David, relying on Jonathan's constancy, a constancy sealed with covenants, knew that he could speak with total candor, and he did. Jonathan asked his friend, "What do you want me to do for you? Pull no punches. Tell me what I can do." And so they come up with this scheme to discern the mind of Saul, which was, of course, kill David. "Who will tell me," asked David, "if your father answers roughly?" "Answer," Jonathan said, "when I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day. Behold, if he is well disposed toward David, shall I not send and disclose it to you? But should it please my father to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also." This is another oath. "If I do not disclose it to you and send you away, that you may go safely." "You have my word," Jonathan says, "David, as a constant friend, as a friend by oath, that I will tell you the truth in all candor, be it good or bad." And the truth, it turned out, was bad. Saul wanted to kill David, and David had to run for his life. And so he went with Jonathan's blessing. Jonathan and David's friendship illustrate constancy, candor, and good counsel. Proverbs 27:9, this taken from the New International Version. It's an odd text, and this is, I think, a better translation. "Perfume and incense bring joy to the heart, and the pleasantness of a friend springs from his heartfelt advice." Proverbs 27:17, "Iron sharpens iron, and one man sharpens another." Sirach 6:15, "There is nothing so precious as a faithful friend, and no scale can measure his excellence." Right along, we've seen how Jonathan was a source of good counsel for David. And I suspect being close friends and fellow warriors and brother-in-laws, there was a great deal of counsel between them that we don't read about. In any case, when it was time for David to get out of Dodge, Jonathan sent him off with good counsel and blessing. Then as David, frightened, running from Saul, hiding in the desert, we read that Jonathan came, and it says that he strengthened his hand in God. Jonathan strengthened David's hand in God, and they renewed and deepened their promise of friendship, of loyalty to one another, this time before the Lord. Jonathan's counsel indicated, as one commentator put it, that far from being downcast, Jonathan remained optimistic about the outcome because he is sure that the Lord will bring about the new era with David at the helm and with me beside you, that is, with Jonathan as the king's right-hand man. And Jonathan counseled David to press on and eventually see that new era come into being. I can't imagine how disheartened David must have been as he ran for his life. And I can't imagine how much his friend's counsel, his counsel in God, encouraged him. This was, let me add, the last time Jonathan and David ever met. The next thing we read about Jonathan is in 1 Samuel 31. "And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines slew Jonathan and Abinadab, Malchushua, the sons of Saul." How the mighty are fallen. Well, there's obviously much more to say about friendship, and we have several days together to say much more about friendship here at the Wyoming School. But constancy, candor, and counsel, I think, will get us started. And I think as we discuss the readings through the week, those three characteristics of friendship from the Scriptures will be useful. As your mom told you, or maybe you moms have told your children. To have a friend, you have to be a friend. How to be a friend? Well, remembering that friendships take time to develop and that we should take care in developing friendships, we can follow the example of David and Jonathan. They exhibited constancy, commitment to each other over the long haul, in the good times and when things were rotten. They demonstrated candor, telling the truth even when the truth was unpleasant. And Jonathan gave good counsel and strengthened David in God. As Gustav Stalin wrote in the quote I had in my introduction, the story that ends with the lament is itself a song of praise of friendship. It is said of the two friends that they loved one another as their own life, the supreme stage of human fellowship. And after all, wasn't it someone very important and famous who said, greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. With that, the 2019 Wyoming School of Catholic Thought began. Next week, the After Dinner Scholar will feature a lecture by Wyoming Catholic College President Dr. Glenn Arbery about two sets of friends, Achilles and Patroclus from the Iliad, and Ishmael and Queequeg from Herman Melville's Moby Dick. Join us then, and maybe tell a friend about it as well. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.